Thank you. Our first case for today, 12 AP 2402, Kaylee Marie Jo Force et al. Versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company. And let me read what I have as the lineup of counsel. Representing Haley Marie Jo Force is a Joseph J. Welsenbeck. 25 minutes, 15 minutes, Donald Piper, representing Regent Insurance Company. 15 minutes, Leslie Shunk, representing American Family Mutual Insurance Company, and Jeffrey Brown. And 5 minutes, rebuttal. You may proceed, counsel.
Good morning, and may it please the court. My name is Joseph Welsenbach, and I represent Haley Marie Jo Force. Seated along with me today is Jason Oldenburg from the Prevent Law Firm in Milwaukee, who represents Megan and Lauren Force. To get right to the point, to cut to the chase, I'm here to persuade you or convince you that these three children of Billy Jo Force should have a right to bring a claim for damages for their father's death. The way I look at the case, I see three fundamental, what I consider public policies at issue here. Number one is that a child has a right to support from his or her parents. Number two, a child has a right to recover for the loss in society and companionship of her father when he's deceased, and that is a statutorily given under 895.04 sub 4, which provides for society companionship damages. And thirdly, a public policy that I feel is important here is that a tortfeasor should be responsible or is responsible for the damage that he or she has caused. And these principles of public policy embody community common sense and common conscience. Now, in looking back briefly at the history here, and I know you've all read this, all read the statement of the case and the facts, I think it's noteworthy to cite that the trial judge, J. Mack Davis from Waukesha, indicated, although he disagreed with my proposition, he indicated that he was sold that there was some inequity here, and he indicated in his decision that the organization of families has been changing over the decades, which we all know. I think it's common knowledge. The Court of Appeals echoed these concerns in its 18-page certification, and the Court of Appeals, as I read it, did segregated three separate arguments or issues, and one was, the court intimated that it would be against public policy to deny Haley Jo and the other two children a right to seek recovery in this action. The court also indicated that the statute itself, at page 11, the statute itself may allow recovery by the minor plaintiffs. And thirdly, the Court of Appeals suggested that the classification set up by the statute, 895.04, denied equal protection and was thus unconstitutional. Now, that's well and good, but the real question, I think, for me to assist this court is, how do we get to my suggested conclusion? That's what we're really trying to do here. And I have several theories, some of which I think are, well, I think they're all good, but I'm sure Mr. Piper is
better than others, right?
I'm sure Mr. Piper won't agree with them. But number one, we need to look at Cogger versus Trudell. That's the main case at issue here, and it was decided back in June 1967, 46 years ago. What is significant to me is the court at page 358 said that in an attempt to protect the children in that case, or any other case, the trial court must work from the amount recovered by the spouse who is charged with the support of the minor children. Now, we all know in this case, Linda Force the surviving spouse was not charged with the support of these three minor children. Linda Force, while married to Billy Joe Force at the time of his death in November of 2010, I believe, or 8, while married to him, had not lived with him, apparently not talked to him, communicated with him in any way, Christmas cards, birthday cards, anything since 1996.
Are you citing that for the proposition that Codger doesn't apply because it's premised on what you just read? A careful reading of the entire section makes it clear that the trial court, in an attempt to protect the children, must work from the amount recovered by the spouse who is charged with the support of the minor children.
I do. And Codger unequivocally said that, and we know that Linda Force was not charged with such duty. And that's why I think Codger, at least in the parameter of the facts of this case, which are somewhat unusual, Codger has to be distinguished or clarified. Now, under Codger, my position is if there is no duty to support, as we have here, if the surviving spouse, Linda, has no duty to support the children of the deceased, Billy Joe's three children, then I think the children should be able to bring their own claim because, as indicated by the court in what I just read, Codger said we have to carve out or share in the proceeds from the spouse who is charged with the support of the minor, of the minor children.
Would analysis be different if these were not minor children? Suppose these were adult children. They were 18 through 22.
I think my analysis would be different for two reasons. Number one, I think the law especially covets the protection of minor children, as I think I cited in the Cole versus the Sears Roebuck case. And number two, the statute itself, 895.04, to me, clearly, unequivocally, sets forth the idea that children are to be protected. And that, and Codger itself says that. Codger indicates that statute is to protect minor children. If there is a surviving spouse, such as Linda here, Linda Force, who has no compensable claim, and it's important to recognize that Linda Force was a party to the lawsuit. By summary judgment, the court found that she had no compensable claim. She had no damages. That's, to me, the law of the case. It was undisputed, really. So the law of the case as we stand here today, and she hasn't appealed that, is that Linda Force, the surviving spouse, cannot receive a dime from the death of her husband. She has no compensable damages. If that's the case, then I would do what the Court of Appeals intimated, and that's simply this. I would carve out, I hate to use the word carve out, I would make a public policy exception so that when a surviving spouse who has no claim, no compensable damages, is in existence, then the children should be able to make a claim. And we really have kind of a, not a perfect storm, but we have two elements here that I think are of major consideration in looking at whether these children should have a claim. Number one is that Linda Force had no duty to support these three kids. And number two, on top of that, she has no compensable claim. Now, it could be, I suppose it could be, that a surviving spouse who had a duty to support still might not have a compensable claim. I think we've given some examples in our brief where maybe a jury just would not give any money to a surviving spouse because they didn't get along. But yet, the children might be deserving of compensation.
Counsel, I'm, for some reason, always a little hesitant when attorneys say, I think such and such. Not because I don't want attorneys to think, But my first response is, show me the statute. Show me the case law. So let's start with the wording of the statute. You said that you think that, you know, it's for the protection of the public, and that's the public policy. Indeed, as I recall in the certification from the Court of Appeals, they said it was not only the purpose, it was expressly the purpose. So let's take a look at the statute. And if you would focus your arguments on the words of the statute, please.
895.04, parentheses 2, the statute sets up what happens if there are minor children under 18. And I would note, first of all, that the statute starts out by saying if the deceased leaves a surviving spouse or domestic partner and minor children. So, number one, the court is specifically, or not the court, the legislature is specifically including minor children in its initial analysis. And then it goes on to say that the court...
Just a minute. With whose support the deceased was legally charged are the next words, right?
Right. Billy Joe Forrest was legally charged with the support of his minor children. There's no question about that. He's the deceased. And if I may, the court of record, the trial court we're talking about, in recognition of its duty and in recognition of the duty and responsibility of a parent to support minor children. That's where I say the statute itself recognizes the parental obligation to support minor children.
Now, when it says in recognition of the duty and responsibility of a parent to support minor children. Okay, so the statute reads, I'll leave out some of this. If the deceased leaves surviving a spouse or domestic partner and minor children under 18 years of age whose support the deceased was legally charged, the court before whom the action is pending, in recognition of the duty and responsibility of a parent to support the minor children. Who's the parent that the legislature is referring to here?
I've read it to be the deceased parent. That's the way I would read it, but it might be ambiguous.
I think the Cogger Court recognized it at page 358 to be both. Let's take a look at page 358. Maybe I'm wrong. When I say both, I mean the surviving spouse and the
departed one.
The deceased. And I think I go back to that very language, I think, that we were just talking about. And let's look at that language at page 358. It says, a careful reading of the entire section makes it clear that the trial court, in other words, the section of this statute we're just talking about, the trial court, in an attempt to protect the children, must work from the amount recovered by the spouse. I suppose that's the surviving spouse, right?
Correct.
Who is charged with the support of the minor children?
True.
So I think the Codger Court interprets the word parent in the statute, according to this, to include the surviving spouse who is charged with the support of the minor child. I was focusing on that because as I was reading the statute and its predecessor statutes and seeing the different changes in the words, the gender changes and stuff, and I wondered to myself, it starts, it used to be he when referring to the deceased, but they changed that now. But I wondered, because the earlier statute, the one that Codger looked at, said, you know, kind of, you know, if he leaves, they presuppose the guys are going to die, I guess. And then they used a different word, parent. And I thought to myself, why are they saying parent? What do they mean by parent? And so I looked at the cases, and it seems to me that they mean both parents have an obligation. And I reread Codger, and sure enough, the spouse who gets the money, who in 358, it says, whose obligation recovered by the spouse who is charged with the support of the minor children. So let's just assume I'm right. Sometimes I'm right, sometimes I'm wrong. Let's just assume that I'm right, that parent means the surviving spouse, in Codger, at least.
Okay.
That's the way they interpreted the statute. What, if any, import does that have?
Well, for our particular case, I don't think it has any importance because Linda Forrest is not.
Well, the surviving spouse here does not have an obligation to support
Absolutely.
These children who are
right.
not her children.
Right.
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 Not her children.
These are not her children. She has no obligation whatsoever to support these children. That's a distinction, I think, between our case and the Cogger case.
Yeah. I'm not as excited about that, but because ultimately, even if there are no children, no adult children, even if there are no adult children or no minor children, if there's no spouse, other people can have a claim under this wrongful death statute.
Under 852.01, the next people in line, I believe, would be parents. Or brothers
right,
and sisters.
Or a brother or a sister.
Brother or sister.
Although special protection is given under this statute for minor children who have to be supported by someone, one parent or other, as Justice Bradley has pointed out, this whole statute protects somebody to get wrongful death proceeds.
Well,
the problem here is you got a spouse who isn't a spouse, but isn't recognized by law as not a spouse. That's your problem, factually, isn't it?
My problem is that she's a spouse, not entitled to any compensation.
Yeah.
She's still a spouse. I would be more than happy to have you conclude that there's some type of common law
non-spouse
here, and give the kids the right to proceed.
Oh, the reason that she doesn't have any compensation is because she hasn't functioned as a spouse for many, 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 many years, right? He hasn't supported her. She hasn't wanted any maintenance. As far as you can tell, there's been no relationship. Isn't that right?
There has been no relationship.
At all.
At all. And she has none of the qualities of a typical surviving spouse who's lived with the husband and loved him and, you know, shared good and bad
it
things.
It just didn't go through the formality of a divorce. Right?
Apparently true. That's true. Undoubtedly true.
Is there any explanation in the record of why Mr. Force didn't divorce his wife or vice versa?
I can tell you what I know, but I can't tell you that it's in the record. And if you want me to tell you what I know, I'll do that, but I'm not sure it's in the record.
Well, we'll look at the record.
I know. But it would not be...
Do you think these children would be allowed to recover even if they were still living as husband and wife?
Well, my argument is that...
I know your argument would be that, but under the statute, I think that's another layer here.
I'm sorry.
You know?
Yes. Under the present law, no, they could not.
Because they're not...
Because
she didn't adopt them and they're not right?
Oh, I'm sorry. If Linda Forrest was married, had been married right now, or was married right now and living with Billy Joe
right.
Forrest, is that what you're saying?
Yes.
These children could not bring an action on their own. They would have to recover from what Linda Forrest recovered, which is...
What right would she have to recover anything to do with the children from him?
Nothing.
Right.
Nothing.
Because she didn't adopt them and they're not her
right.
kids,
right?
Right.
And the
So the issue really is, do these kids, can you find some way? I'm sympathetic to what you're saying. I'm just not seeing where it says it in the statute, so I'm trying to figure it out. How do these kids, who are his children, not hers, find a way to recover something from their deceased father, other than through an estate?
I think there's a couple ways to do it. And number one is we look back to Cogger and the initial decision of Cogger where, as we know, in 1959, the statute clearly said the surviving spouse recovers. And in 1961, the statute was changed, that language was removed. And I personally don't see anything in that statute that says only the surviving spouse can bring this action. And I don't think the Court of Appeals saw that either. So, number one, my argument would be that we should review that Cogger case to see whether or not their interpretation, Cogger Court's interpretation of the change in the statute is correct. Number two, another way that these children should be able to recover, is I look at the law of intestacy under 85201. Now, 85201 says when the husband dies, the spouse takes, unless there are children not of that marriage. And that's what we have here. If this were an intestate proceeding and the husband died, his estate would be divided 50% to the wife and 50% of non-marital property to children not of the marriage, which would be these three kids.
That's why I said other than an estate proceeding.
I'm getting
what you're saying. I'm just trying to figure out how we make the statute say what you want it
but,
to say.
Well, the statute refers at some point in time to 85201 and also the Steinbart case, pretty much indicated that we should follow the intestate statute.
Who then would be you'd just set up a guardianship? Like,
I'm sorry?
You'd just assume these kids could find a way to recover, okay, for the accident, and they could be the beneficiaries. It wouldn't go to her. It would go to them. So then you'd set up a guardianship? That's how you'd
exactly. The money would be determined, or the funds, if any, would be determined per each child, set up in a guardianship until the children are 18. Linda Forrest, or in my theory, any surviving spouse would not have any claim to those children's money. And my whole theory here is, not only in this case, because of the strange facts, should these kids have a claim, I'm going further and saying, in any case where there's a surviving spouse, why do we limit the plaintiff to the surviving spouse when children have their own independent loss? They have their own independent pecuniary loss. They have their own independent society and companionship loss. We let kids do this. We allow children to sue when their father is severely injured under the FEMA case, but we don't do it when their father is dead. It makes no sense to me.
With Justice Ziegler's fact situation, the interpretation that Justice Bradley talked about as to who has the support and what the statute means comes into play and is not as easily dismissed as I was trying to do.
That's right.
It's true. I mean, that's the exact example where it comes into play.
Well, I think what Justice Bradley said, and I respectfully disagree, I think when it says responsibility of a parent, we're talking about the deceased parent.
Well that's not what Cogg seems to say, but go ahead, Justice Bradley.
Counsel, I was surprised at your response to Justice Ziegler, because I thought it was inconsistent with your argument, so let me just clarify.
Sure.
Maybe I misunderstood the question. If the surviving spouse here had a claim, compensable claim, would there be entitlement to the 50% offset or opportunity for 50% offset?
Under the Cogger case, yes.
Children not of the marriage, and that doesn't have a support.
Right. That's okay. What the facts are here.
Right.
That's right. So I'm the only fact I'm changing.
She's white.
If Linda Forrest would recover $5,000, the children would have a right to get up to half.
That's right. And I understood your answer to Justice Ziegler to be different than that.
So did I, actually.
And so
I thought your answer was they don't have the right
and
to recover.
So I want you to clarify your argument, if you would.
Okay. And if I misspoke, I apologize. My argument is simply this. If Linda Forrest gets no compensation, the kids get no compensation. Okay.
But if they're living as husband and wife, and she has the right to bring a claim as his spouse.
Yes.
Where does the statute provide that the minor children that are not her biological children, that are only his biological children, where does the statute provide that they have the right to recover? I mean, what would her damages be as regards the children? What would the evidence be?
Here's the thing. If we go to trial and we have a claim for Mrs. My red light is on. Can I continue?
May respond.
Okay. If we have a claim for Linda Forrest at trial, under jury instruction 1861, the only damages that are proven are hers.
Right. Right.
Not the children's.
So why would they get 50% of her damages? That's my question.
Well, that's what the statute says. They can get up to 50%.
Well, it depends on that phrase that Justice Bradley was talking about again. It depends whether she's the parent with whom the obligation is charged. I mean, I would assume part of the damages have to do with her having the obligation to support the children.
Except she wouldn't.
I know. So how do you get there under the language of the statute?
I don't know. That's the problem.
Does the statute
not trying to be...
No, I understand what you're saying. I don't know how we get there, and that's why I think the kids are...
Your argument's a fairness argument, really. Right?
Among other things, yes.
Well, it seems to me that your brief and your argument pose many, many problems with the statute. I think it would be a mistake to try to resolve all of those problems in this case.
I probably don't disagree with you.
Counselor, if the personal representative of Billy brought an action on behalf of his estate, where do the children fit into that?
Okay. The estate is a plaintiff in this case.
Right.
And here's how that would work. If the estate of Billy Joel Forrest recovers some money for his pain and suffering or pre-death fear or whatever it might be, let's say it's $100,000, that money then goes to the there's an estate set up in Ozaukee County. The estate gets distributed under the intestacy law. 50% of the net after fees and all that, 50% of the net is going to go to Linda Forrest.
Right.
And 50%, since it's non-marital property, 50% will go to the three children of Billy Joel Forrest.
Okay. All right. So they can get something under the estate, and the question is how much he actually suffered before he died, generally.
Right.
That's pre-death, mm-hmm. Not post-death.
That's not wrongful death. Mm-hmm. That's not wrongful death.
No, that's a
survivorship.
Right, right.
Well, it's under the 895.04 statute that we're looking at, right?
Well, it's the estate's really a survival statute,
right.
I think.
Well, it says, this first section says, an action for wrongful death may be brought by the personal representative of the deceased person or by the person to whom the amount belongs.
Correct. But I think the claim for pain and suffering is a survival.
Survival. Yeah, I get it. Okay.
If the estate collects it, the state has to follow the wrongful death statute of who gets the money, not a will, right?
No. If the estate collects the money, it goes under the intestate statute.
On survivorship or wrongful death?
Survivorship.
Survivorship. I totally agree with you.
Because it's his claim.
It's his claim.
It's his, not their claim.
Right, right.
It's his wrongful, it's his pain and suffering before death. It's the things that, right.
Thank you, counsel. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Okay.
Mr. Piper, representing Regent Insurance Company. Well, they're going to tell us what issues you're going to deal with and what issues Ms. Shunk is going to deal with.
I will, Justice. May it please the Court, Donald Piper of Piper and Schmidt for Regent Insurance Company responded. With me today is John Monson, my partner in our law firm, who prepared a lot of the briefing in this case. In the short time that I have, I'd like to try to discuss and explain these points. One, it does matter that Billy and Linda Force never legally divorced. Two, any argument that suggests that these minor plaintiffs cannot recover because, to use the words of the Wisconsin Association of Justice in their brief, they were illegitimate, is simply wrong. Three, the legislature established an order of beneficiaries to promote the institution of marriage. And when I say marriage, I'm including domestic partnership because it's now part of the statute, although it was not part of the statute at the time of Billy Force's death.
Could you repeat, without the parentheses, your third point? Without the... What's the purpose of the statute? That's what you were getting at on three?
The purpose of the statute, I believe, is to promote the institution of marriage and domestic partnership, as well as the importance of family, especially when one head of the family dies. Four, protection of children is important. No one's going to debate that, but it's not the controlling public policy consideration underlying the wrongful death statute. And five, and this is one that I think will really open up a can of worms, if the appellants can create an independent cause of action in this case using fairness as the test, whenever they're unhappy with the recovery of a surviving spouse, that precedent will allow everyone who has a fairness argument to seek wrongful death recovery, and that would be contrary to the order of beneficiaries that the legislature thought was appropriate when we have a death. And don't forget, a death, of course, is a tragic and emotional event that affects family, and a death is a situation where the surviving spouse looks to the wrongful death statute and gets some money, hopefully, for loss of society and companionship and pecuniary loss, which is the expectation that the decedent would have provided support had he or she not died.
Counsel, from the statement of what you're covering, it appears to me you're covering the waterfront. Is that the way you're dividing it? Both of you are going to cover everything?
I'm going to cover these points, and Attorney Shunk is going to cover other points.
What other points are left?
Beg your pardon?
What other points are left?
I'll let her speak, but I believe her points will be equal protection, the case law precedent, deferring to the precedent, deferring to the legislature, things of that sort.
Okay, equal protection in large part.
So maybe even before I start, I could address a couple of quick points in response to Justice Bradley's discussion about Cogger. At the time, Cogger was
I'm sorry, before, and I'm glad you're going to do that, but before you do that, would you clarify your understanding of the current interpretation of the statute vis-a-vis Justice Ziegler's question? Is it your understanding if these the deceased and the surviving spouse had been living as husband and wife, that the children in this fact situation would be able to request an offset?
That is correct, and I think it's important to point out that the plaintiff's complaint alleges as much. At the trial court level, Linda Force was saying, I want recovery for loss of society and companionship and pecuniary loss, and the children will have a set-off for it. She lost on the facts, not on the law. She lost on the facts. She couldn't prove up those claims. And now the minors are saying, oh, that's not fair.
I mean, our job is to take a listen to the arguments, look at the law, look at the precedent. But I just wanted to make clear what I understood your argument was, and that.
So you think she was the person who was legally charged with supporting these minor children who are not her biological children that she did not adopt?
I'm sorry. On that point, the Cogger case considered a statute that used the word he, and the Cogger court determined that he was the surviving spouse. After Cogger was decided, and long before Billy Force died, the legislature changed that statute and made it very clear that the person who is charged with the support was the decedent. That's why we see the words the decedent in the current statute.
Well, counsel, at the time of Cogger's, I bet there was a statute in 990 that said every time we use the word he, it includes she unless it's expressly not. That's the first thing. Second thing, I'd have to look, and I don't know whether the change in the statute here was part of numerous changes in the law to de-sex the law or have general statements so that you didn't get caught with a he or she.
All I can say, I'm sorry. All I can say in response is, I'm quoting from the statute in effect at Cogger, it says that if the deceased leaves surviving a spouse and minor children under 18 years of age with whose support he was legally charged.
Oh, no.
And then it goes on to speak about the parent. Same language.
Yes, it does. Yeah. And the change really had to do with replacing the word he legislatively with the language with whose support the deceased was legally charged. So to that extent, whatever Cogger was relying on as it relates to the spouse having the support obligations was legislatively, in effect, overruled.
You know, I may just have answered Mr. Welchenbach's question for him, but where in the statute does it say any money damages have to be due and owing to the surviving spouse? Maybe the statute just provides that for the children to fit under, there has to be a surviving spouse and the minor children that he has to be responsible for supporting, and then the action can continue. It's not necessarily that you have to have damages for the surviving spouse, but you have to have a surviving spouse, and you have to have minor children that the deceased is responsible for supporting. And so whether she's pursuing damages or not, if I were Mr. Welchenbach, I'd be arguing. Whether she's pursuing damages or not is irrelevant under the statute, because all you need is that existing person and the minor children, if you're reading that initial plain language.
As I read it,
now I've just come full circle on you right here in court. So you tell me why that isn't the answer.
As I read 894.04 sub 2 in its entirety, I see the legislature appropriately saying, we're going to give that spouse the first priority, because that's important for marriage and for family. Somebody has died, the other spouse. Now we have a new head of the family. The family's under stress. We don't want infighting between children and the surviving spouse about who's more deserving. We want, as a matter of public policy, marriage to be promoted, the stability of marriage to be promoted, and we want the family not to be in a state of chaos because of all this. The legislature in 1961 said, all right, we'll go down that path, but let's make sure we don't have the children suffer. So the legislature said we'll take a set off from the spouse's recovery. And the statute says, if any. It doesn't say that there has to be a set off. It says, if any. And the legislature then protects the child so that if there's something in case the surviving spouse isn't responsible enough to take care for that those children, there's something left in a set-off that the court can work with. And where does it say that the surviving spouse gets a recovery first? I believe it says very clearly in the language that says if no spouse survives to the decedent's lineal heirs. Why would the legislature say that if no spouse survives, if the spouse wasn't first in line? The spouse is first in line, and that's what the order of beneficiaries as construed by this court has said over the years, including in Cogger.
There's a separate section, a separate sentence in this section, and you might want to get the statute in front of you. Because
I have it in front of me.
Oh, great. Okay. It's about, I would say, about a third of the way from the bottom, and it says, a surviving non-resident alien spouse or a non-resident alien domestic partner under Chapter 770 and minor children shall be entitled to benefits under this section. And there, the children's entitlement to benefits under the section doesn't really seem to be tied to anything except there being minor children. But you want to talk about that sentence for me a little bit, please?
Well, as I see that sentence, it's focusing simply on what happens if you have a non-resident alien spouse. Obviously, that was a consideration the legislature had, or non-resident alien domestic partner, and they wanted to be sure that the minor children would have the benefits if that was the situation at hand. And again, I said earlier on that it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in this case that the forced children, and everybody loves children, and I do too, but it doesn't matter that these forced children were not Linda Force's children. If Billy and Linda Force had legally separated.
Counselor, you're not where I am. I want you to tell me why the words, and the minor children shall be entitled to benefits under this section, doesn't let these kids that are now plaintiffs sue for benefits under this section. That's what I want you to talk to me about.
My answer to that is that's just a specific reference in that statute with a focus of non-resident alien, and it doesn't change
the children of non-resident aliens. That's not what it says. It's just, to me, a restatement that the children are supposed to be entitled to benefits under.
Well, the children, maybe I can answer it this way, and I'll think I know.
Counsel, what I hear you saying is so long as the same procedures that are set forward in the beginning part of the subsection are followed, then the non-resident aliens can also benefit thereby.
Justice Gableman, I agree. And the big picture is...
You the
question. Well, that's what I heard. That's, Pat, next time, just slip me a note.
Mr. Piper, I'm inclined to agree with your interpretation of the infighting, that whole argument that you gave. But we're faced with a fact situation that really is completely inconsistent with the major premises of the statute. I mean, you want to avoid inviting. You have a spouse who's to support the children. This is a typical marriage situation from the 1960s or earlier. But none of those facts apply here. And so why isn't this simply an absurd result under the statute?
Justice Prosser, my response to that is there's a greater good that we have to consider in this statute. The greater good is the stability of marriage. And Chapter 765, and we quoted from it in our brief, talks about the intent being to promote the stability of marriage and family. It talks about a marriage contract. Talks about the seriousness of marriage and marriage being a legal relationship. The greater good is that the beneficiaries are to recover under a specific statutorily mandated order. And yes, this may be a situation where unfairness is an appealing argument, that the minors don't get anything. But sometimes the individual unfairness has to be subservient to the greater good. It happens in any bright line rule. If order of beneficiaries is a bright-line rule, so is the statute of limitations. What if an accident occurred the day after, I'm sorry, the lawsuit was filed the day after the statute ran and minors weren't able to recover? That would be unfair in the sense that it's sad they can't recover, but the greater good is the stability of claims and the peace of mind the public needs in order to respond to any kind of claim and know that at a certain point in time, it's behind you. It's the same thing here as I see it. The legislature has this order of beneficiaries. In this case, the Forrest children are not going to recover, I believe, should not recover, because it violates the order. They want an exception. And the last thing I'd like to get into, if I could, real briefly, is if you give them an exception, carve out an exception in this case, I think you should be prepared for these kinds of things occurring. In this case, Linda Forrest recovers nothing. What if Linda Forrest recovered $50,000 and the minor said, that's not enough. I want a bigger share of that $50,000. What if she recovered $100,000? Pecuniary damages aren't limited. What if she recovered $1 million and minors said, we want more? I'm sorry.
Let me ask you, I want a practical question. I always end up thinking, how is a case like this tried, right?
I'm only concerned about the red light.
I know, but I got to know the answer to my question. What does a special verdict look like in a case, not like this, but an easier case, where they're married, living together, totally love each other, the whole nine yards, but you got the same children in the same situation? Let's say you've got children of the marriage. I'm looking at the jury instruction and figuring out, okay, trial court judge, how do you instruct the jury? The jury still comes up with a different number for the minor children and their losses. The jury comes up with a number for the loss of consortium, society companionship, things like that, for the spouse. But then there are other questions the jury's asking. It relates to the relationship with the children and what was reasonably expected and all that kind of stuff. So there would be another number in there for the kids, right?
I can tell you I tried a double wrongful death case in Ozaukee County. I know what the special verdict said in that case. There were two widows who were at the plaintiff's tables, sad to say, sobbing during the trial. The estate asked for money for conscious pain and suffering and fear of impending death before the decedent passed away. And that's a separate element of damage. Then we get into what I call the survivorship claim.
Is it just one number? My question is it just one big number for the spouse and the children lumped together? Do the verdicts tend to ask for damages for the spouse and damages for the children?
I don't mean to interrupt. I apologize. The verdict specifically asked for conscious pain and suffering and fear of impending death for the person who died. That's the estate's claim. Then the verdict asked for loss of society and companionship, and that was the spouse's claim. The children were not getting money, according to the verdict. This was the spouse's claim. And then the pecuniary loss claim was the next verdict question, and they had to determine what amount of support would this gentleman, in my case, have provided had he not passed away in this accident. And that basically was the verdict.
But the
medical expenses before the death might have been in there.
Well, when do the children get their share? As I read the statute, the court makes the determination of how much the kids get.
Not
the jury.
Exactly. Well,
I guess my question really is, regardless of how you separate that out, I was going to say, what if the spouse gets a goose egg? The spouse gets nothing. Does that mean the children's claim then gets dismissed because the spouse got nothing, even though the spouse met all the criteria under the statute? That was the point I was trying to get at, and it's easy to make if you separate out the damages to a spouse versus the damages because they're separate instructions. So how do you deal with that? Would the whole claim be kicked because the spouse got nothing?
Let me start over. The children do not have an independent claim. They get an offset from the spouse's recovery. That's why the appellants are urging this court to adopt an independent claim, notwithstanding the order of beneficiaries in the statute. So in this case, the spouse, Linda Forrest, gets nothing as a matter of fact, not law, as a matter of fact. She didn't prove it. She wanted it, didn't prove it. And the minor children that are not hers but are Billy Forrest's children, they don't recover under the order of beneficiaries. The greater good is the order that the statute provides to families in crisis.
Who determines how much the kids get, the jury or the judge?
The The set-off requirement has the court getting involved in that decision.
That's right. So once the jury determines how much the surviving spouse would get,
correct,
then the judge determines the offset with a max of
50%.
That's how I've always interpreted
that's
it.
That's exactly right.
That's right. But
that's exactly right.
That's how you've done it. That's what the special verdict would do. That is
correct. Correct.
Regardless of whether these were her children or not, if she gets zero,
right,
kids get zero, regardless of parentage, vis-a-vis the surviving spouse.
That is correct, and it's, again, because the order for beneficiaries has to be arbitrary. We have to have some bright-line rules. Otherwise, we have unlimited unfairness arguments.
Chief, if I may, I'd like to take you back to Justice Prosser's question and see if we can answer it. His question essentially was that the statute has as a purpose the protection of the minor children, yet your interpretation seems to undermine the expressed purpose in the statute. And when he asked, isn't an interpretation that undermines the express statutory purpose absurd? And your response, well, there was a greater good, and that is the strength of the marriage and family. But could you answer?
Response, but go ahead.
Could you answer that question?
Sure.
Doesn't the interpretation, your interpretation, that kids get nothing, undermine the express purpose of affording protection of the minor children, which is set forth in the statute? And if it undermines an express purpose, don't we normally say that it's absurd?
My response is this. Before 1961, the statute had no provision in it for minor children getting a set-off. In 1961, the legislature said, all right, we probably have heard stories about minors not getting a fair share when the spouse recoveries. We're going to make sure the court gets involved to protect minors. All very laudable goals. I believe that the legislature put in this language about protecting children because they were, in effect, telling the public who reads the statutes, we've switched from no reference to minors to now we're going to look out for minors and make it a set-off from the spouse's recovery. I think the focus of the protecting the minors doesn't create an independent cause of action. It justifies an interesting public policy decision of the legislature to say, well, maybe spouse A or spouse B, we're not going to let you just take the recovery and walk. We're going to watch what you do with it because we're looking out for the benefit of the minors. That's my answer.
Piper, it seems to me the effect of your argument in the order of beneficiaries is that the only beneficiary is the tortfeasor. And I don't see that in the list.
No, I don't believe that's the case. In this particular set of facts, I can understand, Justice Prosser, why you're thinking that way. If we take the big picture once again and realize this is an aberration in terms of factual situations.
You agree this is an aberration?
It's unique from the typical situation, to say the least. In the typical situation, we wouldn't be dealing with this. We would be trusting the surviving spouse to take care of the children, and we would be trusting the trial court who has to review the set-off request and make appropriate decisions so that the minors are not left high and dry.
Why do you say this is not typical? When you look at the statistics that are cited in the brief, in the state of Wisconsin, within the last 2 years, the statistic is 30% of the children born are born to non-marital relationships. Nationwide, the statistic is 40% of children born are born into non-marital relationships. So, boy, this doesn't seem like this is very different than the world of Cogger, I know.
But I'm not so sure if this is all that unique in the world we live in today.
I'm not suggesting that there aren't situations where there are children who are born out of wedlock. I think it happens all the time in today's day and age. I think the important point, however, is that we still have this order, and in this case, all Billy and Linda Force had to do in, what, 11 years, and how can you forget that you're not divorced? This isn't negligence. They made a conscious decision, apparently, to go their separate ways and not worry about being legally married, even though legal marriage is an institution in our society. In this case, if they had gotten a legal divorce and Billy Force had not remarried, the Force children would be recovering. And so I don't see how, whether the children are, to use the Wisconsin Association for Justice's words, illegitimate or not, matters.
Counselor, what if Linda predeceased Billy?
Then,
is there any wrongful death claim at all that the children?
If Linda predeceased Billy, the Force children would be able to recover.
Where does it say that in the statute?
Well, because there's no surviving spouse. It says if no spouse survives, you look to the lineal heirs, and the next lineal heir in the statute would be the children.
Okay. It comes under that sentence, not the first sentence.
It comes under the sentence that if no spouse or domestic partner survives to the deceased lineal heirs, as determined by...
doesn't come under the 50% set off.
No, because that's my position, Your Honor.
You know, that deals only when you have a surviving spouse.
Correct.
And so here, if you have no spouse, well, you do have a spouse. That's your problem. Okay. Mike, let me just do a setup for the next attorney.
Thank you.
My recollection, you have to correct me. My recollection is that common law, there was no wrongful death. It was survivorship, but no wrongful death recovery, right?
That's right.
Would you like me to address that? I don't know.
Yes.
All right.
I'm right on that, am I not?
Common law, there was no recognition of wrongful death. Correct.
So this is totally statutory.
Correct.
And totally a policy set forth by the legislature.
I believe that to be the case, yes.
And theoretically, the legislature could say no more wrongful death recovery sentence. Period.
If it did, it would be the only state in the union that did that, because every state has a wrongful death statute.
We're the only state in the union that recognizes diploma privilege. So, I mean, we got a lot of places where we're the only ones, and that's okay. Maybe one of the few that has an open primary, too, but that's neither here nor there. So you've got a statutory right of action. That's what I'm just trying to set forth, and that everybody here should understand that if I am correct in my various assumptions.
And I agree with you, and my last comment on that very point is if there's going to be a drastic change, if we're going to open Pandora's box, it's really for the legislature to do that.
I set you up for that, so, and I think that's your whole key point that you've been making, but you haven't used those precise words.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Schunk?
May it please the court, my name is Leslie Schunk. I represent American Family Mutual Insurance Company and Jeffrey Brown. Counsel here closed with my big opener. If to the extent that the appellants are upset or about the results here or want to see a change in the way things are done, with all due respect, I believe that they're in the wrong room. They need to be in a bit different part of this capital. This is, as Justice Abramson recognized, this is clearly a statutory cause of action. The court's role in this is to faithfully give effect to the language and defer to the legislature for any policy changes about who may recover and when they may recover. This court has already recognized on many different occasions that the recovery is limited and confined by what is outlined in the statute, dating all the way back to Cogger. in sum, this is just not the correct branch of the government to take up this perceived wrong.
Counsel, I've written a few cases that employ canons of statutory construction as part of the analysis. And one of the canons that I use on occasion when the interpretation would lead to an absurd result. I referred to that earlier. It is the express purpose, according to case law, and I think just by looking at the statute, to provide financial support to the children or make sure the children are financially supported. What do you do when your interpretation undermines the express purpose of the statute? Where are we to go there? And this isn't the first time that someone interpreting a statute undermines the express purpose, but usually we say we won't go with an absurd reading. So what's your thought?
Justice, my thought is the statute as a whole, I think the express purpose set forth by the legislature is an orderly administration of these types of claims. And so I think that the legislature has accomplished that by being very specific about who may recover and when.
Okay. And the case law says, though, the express purpose is to provide support for the children. The express purpose is affording protection, financial protection for the children. That's what the Codger says in 358. It says providing protection and then referring to the words of the statute, it's financial. So, I mean, there are other purposes. Your colleague says the purpose is to promote the greater good in marriage. I mean, you can pick a number of purposes, but I'll tell you, we're always careful when the purpose is expressed, not just what we think or not what we can garner from legislative history. In fact, it was one of the cases that said, I can't remember which one it was that I read, that said, hey, counsel wasn't able to come up with the purpose in looking at the legislative history. And the court said, you don't have to go to legislative history. Look at the very words of the statute. The words of the statute express the purpose, and that's to protect the kids financially. So what are we supposed to do with that kind of result, even though there's several purposes? This is express, and case law has said this is the express purpose.
Well, I think, Your Honor, I would start with the premise that there is a claim here. And as Attorney Piper said, the claim failed on the facts. And so I'm not so sure that I agree that this is completely absurd because a claim is only so good as the facts that support it.
When there is no claim of the surviving spouse, then the purpose, under your interpretation, the express purpose of the statute cannot be effectuated. Is that correct?
Well, I guess I would make the distinction that there is a claim. It's just not a very good claim.
When there's no claim of a surviving spouse that can be maintained, then the express purpose of protecting the kids is not effectuated.
Well, I think that it creates a situation like what we have here, but I think in the end it carries out the purpose set forth by the legislature in trying to keep this orderly.
What do you think is the better purpose? Keeping this orderly, promoting the greater good of marriage, or protecting the kids? In the hierarchy of purposes, what's your argument?
Well, my argument,
elevating?
My argument would be some consistency in the way that the law is applied. And so why we defer to the legislature and the order of beneficiaries that the legislature has set out. So I think, as Attorney Piper was saying, the greater good, I think that the legislature has set forth, and I agree with what they've done, this precise way that these claims are to be administered to give some certainty to litigants. So I would put that.
That's your greatest of purposes. That's what you think the statute is most meant to effectuate.
I do, Your Honor.
I think it's meant to protect the spouse. The very first thing in the statute is a reference to the spouse. In the succeeding sentences,
it's referenced to whether there is or is not a spouse. The whole thing turns on, do you leave a surviving spouse? So the person who dies may have, whether the decedent is male or female, has an obligation to the spouse for support financially and for other benefits and rights. So I think when I read this, I see a protection of the family unit protecting the spouse and then saying, yeah, well, you know, we're afraid of giving the whole thing to the spouse who might remarry, and then the new spouse is going to get control of some of the money, and we got to protect the kids too. But, you know, we limit the protection to the kids. We don't say, hey, we're going to protect all the kids, and they may need 110% of what she collects, in this case, a she, but we're only going to protect the kids up to 50%. So the other 50% protects the spouse. I mean, it's like intestacy where you have children. The legislature says spouse gets her or his share, and the kids get the rest. But you protect both.
I agree. I think that the legislature isn't clear about who's to bring a claim to bring some order to it. And then by placing the spouse in the first position, the legislature has recognized the stability and the importance of the stability of a family. And I know opposing counsel and the association that filed an amicus brief pointed out that the statute also says domestic partner. I think that's a distinction without a difference. We're talking about the stability of a familial relationship, two people who have made a commitment to each other, and that commitment should be first and foremost in considering the order of beneficiaries.
Counselor, do you agree with your co-counsel that if Linda had predeceased Billy, the children should just go ahead and bring the claim and we wouldn't have this problem we're having?
When there is no spouse, the children are next in line to bring a claim.
Okay, so they can bring a claim for wrongful death.
If they had gotten a divorce or Linda had passed, yes, then the children would be next in line for a claim.
Right. And how do you fit that within the statutory wording? Where do you see that? First sentence of sub 2 says, if the deceased leaves surviving a spouse or domestic partner under Chapter 770 and minor children of under 18 years of age, so you're interpreting the and before minor children as an or, right?
Well, I think the statute takes that into account. It first addresses when there's a spouse and there's children living. Then it addresses when there's a spouse and there's no children. And then further on down, it addresses when there's no spouse but there are children.
But tell me, read to me what you're relying on for that latter proposition.
I'm a little more than halfway through paragraph 2.
Okay.
And it reads, if no spouse or domestic partner survives, to the deceased lineal heirs as determined by section 85201. The children are the next lineal heirs under that section.
Okay, so that's what you rely on for their having an independent action.
Yes, the legislature sets up this scenario where the courts consider if there are children and there's a spouse, and they're saying, okay, no spouse, then we just turn to 852 and we look at who's next in line, and that's where the children come into play.
And that person then has the right to bring the action.
Correct, and then if there's no children, it goes next to who's ever behind them.
All right, thank you.
May I ask, I don't recall that any of the parties have cited 89503 of the statutes. Are you familiar with that?
As the statute that creates the cause of action, I don't have it right in front of me, but the statute that creates the cause of action, then the next section delineates whose cause of action it is.
It's the general overriding.
That's right. It seems to me we sort of accept the premise that wrongful death was not an action at common law. Okay. And very early on, legislatures rushed in to create a statutory right to recover from a wrongful death. And so we're sort of saying, well, the legislature took over. If the legislature hadn't stepped in so quickly, I'm sure the common law would have provided remedies for wrongful deaths of people. We've got an negligent infliction of mental distress and all kinds of torts. Certainly, if one person negligently or otherwise kills a person, that would have been eventually recognized here. So it seems to me the purpose of the statute is in 895.03, and 895.04 is really a kind of dispute about who has priority in getting the right. But the position that you folks are taking is that because of this dispute within 895.04, the tortfeasor doesn't have to pay a damn thing. That just makes no sense to me.
Well, Your Honor, it's not, I repeat myself, but it's not because the tortfeasor is getting away with something. It's because it's the plaintiffs here and have lost on the facts. The claim, they had a claim, they brought the claim, but they couldn't prove up the damages. And so I don't look at it as if the tortfeasor walked away with, you know, scot-free. I look at it, well, my client, Jeffrey Brown.
How can you say there isn't a legitimate claim here? I mean, you have three relatively young children. They were living with the father who died. There was all the kind of relationship here. There's pecuniary loss. How can you say there isn't a claim there? It is just a curious, almost absurd happenstance that they're not permitted to make that claim.
But the claim I speak of is Linda Force's claim. And so I'm saying that Jeffrey Brown, my client, the driver of the other vehicle involved in the accident, he's susceptible to a wrongful death lawsuit. But like any other personal injury suit, any other suit that's filed in the Wisconsin courts, you have to come into court and prove up your loss and your damages. He gets sued, and the plaintiff comes in, and Linda Force can't prove up damages. And according to the statute, that's it.
I have to ask you the same kinds of questions. I'm trying to remember trying these wrongful death cases, and you know, I get the idea of the damages pre-death and how those relate to the estate and all that, and then post-death, the claims that survive death. That's the wrongful death kind of claim we're talking about. And when I look at the jury instructions, 1861 provides for pecuniary loss for the death of a spouse or domestic partner. And that would be an instruction the jury would receive, right?
I would expect so.
And then you go into 1870, death of spouse, surviving spouse's loss of society and companionship. Would that be one that would be given to a jury?
I would expect the plaintiff would request that one.
Okay. And that seems like it's like, you know, it says question blank asked. So, I mean, that's a different question that's asked. Then there's a subdivision for expenses, that'd be something else. Then it has 1880, death of a parent, pecuniary loss. Would that be given in a wrongful death?
Well, I think it depends on who the beneficiary is. If we're talking about when the plaintiff is married, then no, I don't believe so. If we're talking,
so the children aren't part of an action if the plaintiff's still married?
No,
only
because
the spouse?
No, just the spouse, because the trial court then looks at whatever the jury awards the spouse, and in its discretion, sets aside up to 50% of what is awarded to the spouse for the protection of the children. And I see that my red light
let
is
me,
on.
Let me see if I understand your argument. As I interpret what you have said to Justice Prosser and Justice Ziegler, it's this. 895.03 is the statutory statement keeping alive or making alive, because it wasn't before, a wrongful death action. That is your general statute, right? If it ended there and you didn't have anything else, then general rules of tort liability would occur, and the surviving spouse could sue for
his or her damages, the kids could sue for their damages, et cetera, right?
And you have to forgive me, I don't have 895.03 right in front of me.
It is a it's in chapter, it's in the sixth volume, and it's at page 186. Right? Okay. The page numbers are on the top. Well, it says, whenever the death of a person is caused by a wrongful act, if the death neglect is such as would have, if death hadn't ensued, the party injured is entitled to maintain an action to recover damages as if death had not ensued. So your same rules apply. If you just look at that, right? That's your general, it survives action.
Yeah.
And then 895.031, 895.035, et cetera, expand on and expound in 895.04 on these survived death actions, as I understand your argument.
Yes, so 895.04 is the legislature's way of administering the claim created by 895.03.
It limits it.
Correct.
Because if you just stopped at 895.03, you would just apply general tort law, and you'd say the kid has, it's his or her own recovery, right? Just in a regular auto accident where the victim doesn't die, the children can sue for damages, right? For their own damages, right? Loss of companionship.
It certainly appears that way if 895.04 weren't explicitly written out and set out by the legislature.
That's your argument. Your argument is, okay, 03 is general, but you have to read it in context.
Correct.
And the context you read it in is that the recovery is limited under 895.04.
I think the legislature has been clear about it in the courts since that time, and I think it's significant that in all the decisions that have come down from this court and the Court of Appeals, in which children, you know, have not been able to recover, or a grief party has not been able to recover, the legislature has never gone back and changed that or made any amendments.
Jesus, I mean.
Yeah.
The kids clearly have a loss here, that is loss of support. And so your position is, even though the kids would encounter a loss, I'm going to use the word claim, as opposed to an action, because the statute 895.03 uses the word action. So the kids have a claim, but they cannot exercise their claim because the surviving spouse can't maintain a cause of action. That's your position, right? That's your position.
Yeah, I might use a word other than the kids have a claim. The kids, you know, have been affected by the...
They have damages.
Yeah, well,
They have sustained damages because, as the statute says, it's the obligation of the parent to provide support, and now there's no support.
Well, yeah, of course I'm going to concede to the court that the children of Billy Joe Force, you know, it's a terrible situation. They're without their father, and there's some, you know, loss to the family relationship there.
But, no, that's not my question. They have damages, right?
They have damages which I do not believe are compensable because Linda Force is...
Yeah, because she can't maintain a cause of action. That dovetails at this late date. I don't want to get too much into your equal protection argument, but it seems to me then that kids who are in a situation where there is a loving relationship that's ongoing can get compensation for their loss. The kids who are involved with adults who don't have a loving relationship can't get compensation.
Well,
something smells with that.
Well, I think first you need to look at the children as a class of children who have married parents. And I'm not necessarily even talking about married to each other, but a parent or parents who are married. So I think that's the class that we're looking at here. And every child in the state who has whose parents are married is treated exactly the same under the statute. They don't have an independent cause of action, regardless of whether the parents, you know, have the most loving relationship ever or are, don't speak or, you know, are just an average married couple.
And they can get compensated then under the facts of this case if they were married, if they were truly living in a marriage situation.
If you could prove up, if the spouse could prove up some damages.
That's right.
But the forced minors in this case are not treated any differently because if I'm married, if something, God forbid, happened to my husband, my children wouldn't be able to file a lawsuit. It would still be my case. So in that sense, every minor child is treated exactly the same.
Except some kids get money and some don't.
Depending on the relationship of the spouse. And I think that's a really dangerous thing for the court to delve into because then you're asking the trial courts and the upper courts to start making independent valuations of private familial relationships. And then I don't know where you stop if you start down that road.
Your red light is on. You were supposed to do an equal protection argument.
I was prepared.
Planned to do an equal protection.
I was prepared to discuss a number of things, and because of the way the question went, my outline is kind of, you know, best preparation. So
I have a two-sentence equal protection argument you want to give.
Sure. If you're going to make me reduce it to two sentences, the equal protection argument is a really hard one for the plaintiffs to make here. Their burden is beyond a reasonable doubt, and the court itself is not. To concern yourself with the wisdom or the correctness of what's going on here, the task of drawing this classification is the legislature, and perfection by the legislature is not expected or possible. The highlights. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Wilson-Mock.
All right. I would like to address a couple quick things here. Justice Rogan raised an interesting question when she referred to part of, I think it's subsection 2. The response from a counsel that just talked said that the statute says that if no spouse survives, then to the lineal heirs. The statute says more than that. If we look at subsection 2, it says, and I'm going to quote in the middle, it says, if there are no surviving minor children, the amount recovered shall belong and be paid to the spouse or domestic partner. Then, semicolon, if no spouse survives to the deceased lineal heirs. Uh-huh. So my reading of that statute is that if there are no surviving children, then the spouse gets the money, which is consistent with what Justice Rogensack pointed out, that the beginning of paragraph 2 says if the deceased surviving a spouse and minor children, not just a surviving spouse, but and minor children. Justice Ziegler asked, how do we handle these cases at trial? Well, there are no questions on that verdict about what money the children get. The only questions are, pursuant to 1861 and 1870, what's the pecuniary loss to the mother or surviving spouse? What's the loss of society and companionship to the surviving spouse? And then, taking the amount in the verdict, the trial court will then as the Chief Justice pointed out, the trial court will then divvy up the money. Let's use the word divvy up. I don't know if that's a fair way to say it. But up to 50%. And if there's eight kids, I have six kids. Each kid would get 1/6, I guess. Here they get a third of the 50%. That's why I'm thinking, and maybe I'm way out there, but I'm thinking, why can't these children independently make their own claim? The court system isn't going to break down. We have much more difficult cases to decide at trial levels. Many of you have been trial judges. This would be a walk in the park, I would think, to divvy up the verdict, to set the verdict up here. It's not that big of a difficult of a deal. The other point that was made was...
The problem is the verdict for the mother was... the verdict for the spouse was zero. That's very easy to divide up.
Well, if we're forgetting about the kids, Sure. Well, that's
I don't understand where under sub 4 it says it's limited to just damages due to the spouse. I know there's that one sentence in there that talks about consider where, you know, the children, you know, the support that would come with respect to the children. But where in sub 4 does it limit it to damages to a spouse if there is a spouse? It seems wide open there to me.
And I agree. The limitation that there's. The limitation is that only the surviving spouse is allowed the right to make the recovery under Conger. It's inherently ambiguous. And you're right. We're talking about children having the right to get lost in society, but they only get that right under their thinking, the respondent's thinking, when there is no surviving spouse.
I guess I don't understand why that second jury instruction isn't given as to the children so that the jury can award an entire amount that encompasses all damages due and owing. They're in the conjunctive.
That would be my argument.
And the child, and the damages section certainly isn't, it's capped.
But
it's not limited.
That's what I'm saying should be done. But under the law, that is not what's done.
But the legislature amended that statute in 75, right? And Conger preceded that, didn't it?
Conger was June of 67, and the statute amendment of what?
Wasn't it amended in 75? I'm just looking at the jury instructions. It talks about the amendment to broaden the right to pecuniary losses and wrongful death actions. Prior to the amendment, it was restricted.
I think the society and companionship, if I remember, and I looked at this, goes pretty far back, but it was like $3,000 at one time or something like that. I don't know when that society and companionship came in, but it came in, I think, before Conger. I think Conger's statute at the time of Conger had a society and companionship element to it. If I may, I'd just like to address that, whether or not this should be just a legislative change. And certainly the legislature can amend the law, but I think this court can do the following. I think, as I mentioned before, distinguish Conger. Two, hold public policy mandates the right for the children to have a claim. Three, there's an inherent ambiguity in the statute, and I say the ambiguity is this. If only the surviving spouse can bring suit, what do we do where the surviving spouse has no compensable damages when the statute clearly calls for protection of the deceased children? And I say this, I think that the court can fill in the gap. The court can construe a statute to avoid absurd results. That's found in Steinberg at 165, and I think Justice Bradley referenced that.
Well, it doesn't have to be absurd. It can be unreasonable.
Or unreasonable.
Steinberg says unreasonable or absurd. Okay. Unreasonable might be an easier standard than absurd.
And I think both qualify here. As far as the, or my red light's on, should I?
You may finish a sentence or sit down as you wish.
I will sit down.
Thank you, counsel. As long as they stand, you're subject to questions. That's always dangerous. I want to thank all the counsel for their arguments in this case. We've had a number of wrongful death cases raising a whole variety of issues, but this is somewhat novel. And we appreciate your briefs and your argument and your responses to questions. So that ends our hearing on 11AP2402, Haley Marie Jo Force and others versus American Family Mutual Insurance Company and others. We'll take a brief. We were scheduled to have some students come in. So the court is in recess for a few moments. Thank you.